Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and this episode is entitled Cheetah, in her own words, and that is because Cheetah Rivera's memoir is out now, and it's a wonderful read. Cheetah, of course, is a 10-time Tony Award nominee. She won 2 Tony Awards as Best Actress in a Musical for The Rink and Kiss of the Spider-Woman. She wrote her memoir along with the help of journalist Patrick Pacheco. She does spend some time talking about her personal life and her childhood, but her main focus of the book, which makes it really fascinating, is all of her work throughout her very illustrious Broadway career. And I think the best way to get a feeling for the autobiography is to hear Cheetah in her own words with samples from the audio version, which is also available on MP3 CD. And I personally, when I purchase these kinds of Broadway autobiographies, I love getting the audiobooks because I like hearing these people telling their own stories in their own words. Thus, we have Cheetah in her own words. So we're going to hear her along with some great show tunes that she sang on Broadway. The memoir, of course, goes into fascinating detail about her childhood, her pursuit for dance, but we're going to begin with the show that changed her career, Can-Can.
The year was 1954. I had turned 21, and much to my surprise, I was in a smash hit on Broadway, Can-Can. Written and directed by Abe Burrows and choreographed by Michael Kidd. In fact, this show would see the beginning of my career, and the gardener would be none other than Gwen Verdon. One afternoon between the matinee and evening performances of Can-Can, I was on my way to the chorus dressing room of the Schubert Theater on the 3rd floor when Dee Dee Wood, my friend and fellow castmate, caught up with me. "Cheetah, Gwen is looking for you," she said. "Gwen Verdon wants to see me? Why?" I said. Dee Dee just shrugged her shoulders. Worried that I'd done something wrong, I hurried back down to the 2nd floor where Gwen, the breakout star of Can-Can, had her dressing room. Even though I was 6 months into the run, I didn't really know her all that well. At that time, chorus kids rarely, if ever, socialized with the stars of a production and didn't talk to them unless they were summoned. What made Gwen's request even more puzzling was that I had earlier auditioned to understudy her in the featured role of Claudine. She was one of the laundresses who nightly danced the naughty Can-Can at the nightclub run by Le Môme Pistache, played by the French star Lilo. To my disappointment, I didn't get the gig. Who was I kidding, anyway? How could I have had the charisma to step into Gwen's shoes if called upon? I could just imagine the groans when the stage manager announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, at this performance, the role of Claudine, usually played by Gwen Verdon, will be played by Conchita Del Rivero." Conchita who? Maybe in time I could manage that, but not now. The door to Gwen's dressing room was open, so she first saw me reflected in her makeup mirror, standing by the door. She was dressed in her striped costume, with red hair piled atop her head, in an updo and a velvet choker around her neck. She beckoned me to grab a chair and join her at the dressing room table. As I sat down beside her, I was taken in by her luminous green eyes, flawless complexion, and wide mouth, which had broken out into a welcoming grin. The air was suffused with the smell of grease paint mixed with her favorite perfume, and to my mind, the confidence of an actress who was wowing the audience night after night. Turning to me, Gwen said in that unmistakable, quivering voice, "Listen, Cheetah, I know you may be discouraged that you didn't get the understudy job, but let me tell you something. You don't need to understudy anybody. Be more confident. Go out and create your own roles. Forge your own path. I felt my face flushed, as though a weather system was flowing through me. She had just blown open a door. But to where? I wasn't sure. I just knew that in that moment, my life had changed. Both Beatty and I left Shoestring to be in Victor Young's Seventh Heaven, a musical melodrama about star-crossed lovers, a soldier, and a young woman of easy virtue during World War I. The show, which starred Gloria De Haven and Ricardo Montalban, really didn't work. But since it was set in the racy Montmartre of Paris, you just had to have a madam played by Beatty, and a trio of hookers, Camille, Colette, and Fifi, played by Geri-Ann Raphael, Patricia Hammerly, and moi. Since the costumes were designed by Marcel Verte, who won an Oscar for the film Moulin Rouge, we were the most gorgeous streetwalkers in Broadway history. The best part of Seventh Heaven was working with a short, light stroke of lightning called Peter Gennaro, one of the three dancers who introduced Steam Heat, Bob Fosse's iconic number in the pajama game. I'd met Peter in Guys and Dolls and, impressed with his torrid moves, took his jazz dance classes. The actress Grace Kelly, who also took his classes, was a friend of Gant Gaither, the co-producer of Seventh Heaven. She recommended Peter to him, and that led to his debut as the show's choreographer. It was an inspired choice and meant the dances would be fast, furious, and sexy as hell. "Yeah," Peter would say, "it's kind of wild, but that's the wild I want it to be." Peter knew of my early background and so devised a 5-minute white and gold ballet for the show, which I danced with Scott Merrill, a handsome hunk and damn good dancer. When it came to the struts and bumps of My Lady of the Night, however, I fumbled at first. I found Peter's modern jazz contractions odd and a little more than suggestive. Since he had partnered and then married a ballet dancer, Jean Kinsella, he was the perfect bridge between the two worlds. He noticed that I had a hard time getting the bump, a point of sale for any hooker. I found it vulgar. But Peter was the first one to show me a release and contraction with feet turned in, not out. That managed to shape my body in a totally different way than the ballet's five positions. Cheetah, you're a ballet dancer, but like me, you have fast feet, quick hips, and a feeling for the music, he told me. You get the rhythms. Let them carry you. Trust it. You can't make a vulgar move. Following Peter's advice, I got my first good notices for dancing, thanks to him. Critic Frank Quinn wrote, Cheetah Rivera is a gal of flashy, bold personality who struts and slinks like a panther. She does a howl of a routine with her calypso can-can. What I learned from Peter then, and later in West Side Story, continued to bless my career, particularly when I worked with Bob Fosse, the guy who put Peter, along with Buzz Miller and Carol Haney, on the map in the pajama game. Fosse's pelvic thrusts were tighter, more subtle, and more erotic. But Peter's lessons gave me the freedom to explore sexuality without being overridden by the watchful figures on my shoulder. God on one, my mother on the other.
Camille, Colette,
Fifi.
Three ladies of the boulevard are we. Our trade may be shady, but we do. For this we charge a very modest fee. Camille,
Fifi,
Colette, three little girls you never will forget.
Mon chou, when you're lonely on a
On my dressing room table at home, among the crystal heart and the many framed photos of dear friends and family, there is one that stands out. I am in profile. My head is bowed, and I am kissing the slender ebony fingers of a man, Sammy Davis Jr., a friend and a one-time lover. His face, framed in his trademark dark-rimmed glasses, is calm, which was almost never the case with him. Like so much that went between us, the kiss is sweet, a sign of respect for his talent and for what that talent cost him. However, before I met Sammy in the winter of 1956, my approach toward him was decidedly different. In fact, when I heard he was coming to Broadway in a new show called Mr. Wonderful, I was unimpressed. "What's he doing on Broadway? He's a nightclub singer," I said to my friend Dee Dee Bryan, then working as an assistant to a young photographer named Richard Avedon. My nose was almost as high as the puff of smoke emanating from the Camel cigarette billboard under which we were then walking at 44th and Broadway. "I wouldn't be so hoity-toity, Miss Cheetah Rivera," she responded defensively. Dee Dee's husband, John Ryan, was the stage manager for Mr. Wonderful. "You weren't exactly playing Lady Macbeth in your last show, a streetwalker, as I recall." "A lady of the boulevard," I corrected her, defending Fifi in Seventh Heaven. "Not just anybody can do 8 shows a week with a snap of a finger. Club acts are on for what, an hour? For a couple of weeks at a time? He'll be toast in a month." "We shall see," said Dee Dee. "Julie Stein is producing, but not writing the music, and he's no dummy," she said of the composer, who had yet to write such iconic musicals as Gypsy and Bells Are Ringing. She continued, "Don't underestimate him, Cheetah. He has a big hit with Hey There, and his gigs are selling out like crazy. Johnny says that the advance is huge, bigger than My Fair Lady. That show was opening a week after Mr. Wonderful." What piqued my interest was that Dee Dee said John had told her that there was a role perfect for me. "You should try out for the show," she said. With a mischievous grin, she added, "And, Cheetah, she has her own number. I'm available." "Don't tell me she's a hooker, right?" I said. "A lady of the boulevard," she said.
"I told you. My name is Rita Romano. When you're booking, if you're looking for a brassy act, I'm available. I'm available. If some night spot in the right spot needs a classy act, I'm available. I'm available. And to get recognition, I will even audition. And if you'll only try me, then the public will buy me. When you're aching to be making a discovery, I'm available. I'm available."
Have you ever seen anything so absolutely captivating? I'm very sexy in a high-class way. Aren't I adorable? Couldn't you just die? Have I ever told you I was single? I'm a
available. I'm available. Don't fight it.
West Side Story became a landmark musical, but the mythology around it was yet to come. The Music Man won the Tony Award for Best Musical over it that year. Our first run lasted nearly 2 years, but West Side wasn't for everyone. It didn't land on Broadway with a massive explosion. The true aficionados knew that they were seeing something amazing. But the regular audiences found it easier to respect us than to love us. Our show was dark, violent at times, and real. Each act ended with a death. Maybe it was just too much, too soon, too close to home. Hal Prince had often said, "I'm not interested in giving audiences what they want. I'm interested in giving them what they didn't know they wanted." And that realization takes time. With West Side Story setting such a high bar in my career, I took myself a little more seriously for what was to come, but not too seriously. Do that, and you become a bitch. I am often asked, how did it feel to be in West Side Story? The simple answer, ecstasy. I realized early on, even in rehearsals, that this show was a gift from God. I felt a tap on my shoulder and heard a voice not unlike that of James Earl Jones saying, "Cheetah, I'm now going to give you this present. Just do what you have to do to be worthy of it." Ever since then, I have tried my best to honor that promise. As Pedro Julio Figueroa del Rivera would say, gracias, adios. This one was for you, Daddy.
Immigrant goes to America. Many hellos in America. Nobody knows in America. Puerto Rico's in America. while the world roars in America.
Our champion was being tactful but direct. We were in the dining room of the Gorham Hotel early in 1960, and he was sizing me up. He was looking to see whether I could play the character of Rosie, a starring role in the first big Broadway musical he was directing and choreographing, a show called Bye Bye Birdie. "Look, Cheetah, I thought you were very good in West Side Story," he said, looking dapper in a yellow cardigan and slender in the tightest houndstooth pants I'd ever seen. "But if I was being considered to play a role unlike any I'd ever played, you'd be curious if I could do it. So what I'd like to know is, can you be light and vulnerable?" "Me? Light and vulnerable? Sure." But there was a more specific question hanging over the lunch. "Mr. Champion, please call me Gower," he said. "Okay, Gower," I replied. Then I added, joking, "and you can call me Dolores Conchita Figueroa del Rivera Montestuco Florentina Canimacro del Fuente." He laughed. "Is that really your name?" he said. "Honest to God, my full birth name, but I never use it," I replied. "And with a name like that, isn't what you're really wondering is, can she play anything other than a Latin tomato?" Gower grinned, showing the whitest, straightest teeth right out of Hollywood. I figured that my Puerto Rican ethnicity might be the elephant in the room. Ed Padula, the producer of Bye Bye Birdie, had told me as much when he set up the lunch. Months earlier, while I was performing in West Side Story in London, he had asked Gower, who was then in the UK himself, to check out my performance. Gower had sent Ed a wire back. "Cheetah's great, but she'll turn our Rosie into a Spanish omelet." Spanish omelet, Latin tomato, sexy spitfire. Call me naive, but it had never occurred to me that I couldn't play just about anything that was handed to me. Hell, I'd already played Fifi, the French streetwalker, Rita Romano, the Italian Corinne, and even Marilyn Monroe, the blonde siren of show business. 3 years later, I'd play Linda, I enjoy being a girl, low, in Flower Drum Song. Typecasting was something forced on us from the outside. Producers, directors, and casting agents were used to playing it safe. And in 1960, there weren't a lot of Latino stars making a splash. Desi Arnaz's Ricky Ricardo was something of a lone wolf out there, and Lucille Ball had gone to the mat to get him cast in her popular TV series. Perhaps my momentary gambit to become Cheetah O'Hara had been a concession to that kind of thinking, but my impulse was always to make a joke of stereotyping. That was kind of why I thought my mouthful of a name could be an icebreaker with Gower. For a moment, I thought it might have backfired, but then Gower said, "Why don't you take a week and prepare something to show me what you can do? That is, if you want the role." Did I ever? I fell in love with Rosie and the musical the minute I heard about it from my agent, Dick Seth. What appealed to me about Bye Bye Birdie was just how much it was the flip side of West Side Story. The raw gangs rumbling on the streets of New York had changed into the giggling teenagers gossiping on phones about who was going steady with whom. After Carol Haney turned down the role of Rosie, Dick called to tell me that Michael, along with the songwriting team of Charles Strauss and Lee Adams, were interested in playing the score for me. All of us had worked together on Shoestring Review 5 years earlier. Lee and Michael had written the Maryland skit that had brought me my first major notices. Additionally, I'd met Ed, our producer, when I did Seventh Heaven. He'd been assistant to the director. I was learning that Broadway could sometimes seem as small a town as Sweet Apple, Ohio. Michael, who would go on to write such smash hits as Carnival, Hello Dolly, and Barnum, was the short, wiry dynamo, fast and funny. Ed Padula called him a cross between Peter Pan and Dorian Gray, with the determination of a feather boa constrictor. Charles was as intense and ambitious as Lee was laid back, and they too would go on to write more hits, including Applause for Lauren Bacall and Golden Boy for Sammy Davis Jr. On our way up to Charles's apartment, Dick cautioned me to play it cool. I was to adopt my best poker face so that at the end of the evening, he could tell them, "We'll have to think about it." "That way, I can get you a better deal," he said. We settled into the living room with drinks, and Michael gave me a synopsis of his witty script. Then he handed the floor over to Charles and Lee. Once they started in on the songs, "A Lot of Living to Do" and "Put on a Happy Face," I couldn't contain myself any longer. I jumped off the couch and said, "I've got to do this show." Dick slapped his forehead, but our youthful energy, I was 27, they were all in their 30s, could have levitated the building.
"His going in the army is the best thing he could do. Now you're free to start to do what you wanted to. Albert, Albert, Albert. I remember how you told me I should trust you for a year. It would just be for a year, but it's 8 years, Albert. 8 long years, Albert.
Rosie, it takes time to build a business."
"It was only a sideline, that's what you said. You just needed some money, that's what you said. You were going to college and get ahead. Instead of being a music business bum, you were going to NYU and become an English teacher. An English teacher, an English teacher. If only you'd been an English teacher, we'd have a little apartment in Queens. You'd get a summer vacation, and we would know what life means. A man who's got his master's is really someone. How proud I'd be if you had become one. It could have been such a wonderful life. I could have been Mrs. Peterson, Mrs. Albert Peterson, Mrs. Phi Beta Kappa Peterson, the English teacher's wife."
"Oh, Rosie, I told you, as soon as I get a few bucks ahead..."
"You said that before, Albert. Then along came Conrad Birdie. And it was goodbye, Geoffrey Chaucer. Hello, William Morris. Goodbye, NYU. Hello, Al Maylou. 'Cause when you wrote Conrad's first hit, Ugga Bugga Boo, then I knew that was it. You were through with English forever. An English teacher is really someone. How proud I'd be if you had become one. It could have been such a wonderful life. I could have been Mrs. Peterson, Mrs. Albert Peterson, Mrs. Phi Beta Kappa Peterson, the English teacher's wife.
Anyanka, the gypsy princess I played in Bashur, wasn't really as nasty a piece of work as my song in the show, Mean, suggested. She was actually something of a romantic with rough edges, the kind of role that I then excelled at. Though the musical is considered something of an also-ran in the annals of musical theater history, Bashur had a rather healthy run of 8 months in 1964. It also received a couple of well-deserved Tony nominations for my friends, the actress Nancy Dussault and Peter Gennaro, who choreographed. The musical is probably unrevivable now, even in a concert version, and that's because of its subject matter, gypsies, a word that has since fallen out of favor. Bashur was about those people you see in storefronts in some cities, eager to tell your fortune or give you a tarot card reading. They are representative of the Roma, an ethnic group generally thought to be nomads, who are organized into clans around the world. In Bashur, Anyanka is the daughter of the Moiva King of Newark, who has attracted the eye of a New York City leader, cockeyed Johnny Dembo, played by Herschel Bernardi. Johnny wants to raise his profile by buying Anyanka as a bride for his son, Steve, but needs $9,000 to do so. Anyanka is no shrinking violet. She takes one look at Steve, played by a hot, hunky actor named Gus Trakonas, and says to Daddy, "Not a problem. I'll make the money myself by pulling off a Bashur," or words to that effect. Bashur is Romani for a grand swindle. Ed Padula, who produced Bye Bye Birdie, thought of me for Anyanka, and I'm glad he did. I had a great time dressed in hoop earrings, lacy shawls, and spangled skirts designed by Freddie Wittop, and flashing them around like a dervish. Peter's dances were terrific. And I loved leading the chorus in his wild numbers. There was one super talented dancer you couldn't miss. He was adorable, swift, and ambitious. His name was Michael Bennett. One regret I have is that, apart from this show, we never managed to work together. I quickly became friends with Nancy, who played Emily, an anthropologist digging into the Romani subculture. She often joined me for my research trips to the fortune-telling parlors along 8th Avenue and Hell's Kitchen. I'm as much a sucker as the next person when it comes to psychics and seers. I had my fill of some of the best in the business while I was living in California. But what I picked up from the women in curtained rooms off Times Square was less about my future and more about how to string a person along so they keep dipping into their purse. Once the show was running, I would often get backstage visits from the royal members of the Romani people, who seemed to get a kick out of the show. They weren't in the least hesitant to make themselves quite at home or swoon over Gus, like almost every woman and a couple of men. I was among them.
You each may be a vicious, malicious maligner and skillful at petty intrigue. But ladies, you must remember that your vices are minor, while mine are major league. Harmless little germs. I'm a sharp. I'm a victim, I'm a sharp. A cactus to you, sickly, prickly pears. A pungent Limburg cheese to you, insipid camembert. So trust me, there's every reason you should trust me. Trust me, there's nothing else that you can do. If you try becoming nasty 'cause you doubt me, dears, you'll quickly learn one thing about me, dears. I can be nastier than you to you, because I'm dirty, rotten, mean. I'm a mean. I'm a victim, I'm a mean. I've got more callous malice deep inside than ever lived in Dr. Jekyll's hide. Simply curdles in my veins. So trust me, 'cause I'll get mad if you don't trust me. Trust me, or else I'll fight you to the end. When I'm mad, I fight as hard as 9 or 10 of me. You wouldn't want me for an enemy, so better take me for a friend, my friend, because I'm stinking rotten mean. Na 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 na. Now do you trust me?
We trust you.
That's nice.
There's every reason we should trust you. We trust you, 'cause you're so gentle and serene. Like a saint, you look so honest and sublime and pure. You talk so quiet and so sublime and pure.
At the beginning of almost every performance of Chicago, when the stage manager called "Places, please," I took my position in an elevator in the basement below the playing area. It would whisk me, standing in a large cylindrical drum, up to center stage to begin the show. Before that, however, I paced the floor, giving myself a pep talk. Invariably, the stagehands asked, "Who you gonna be tonight, Cheetah?" Of course, my first obligation was to be Velma Kelly, the merry murderess of Cook County Jail. But Bob Fosse, our director and choreographer, along with the show's brilliant set designer, Tony Walton, had come up with a spectacular entrance for me. I entered alone onto the stage against a vaudevillian backdrop of dazzling neon. I felt the need to summon up in my imagination a glamorous star in order to carry it off. "What do you think, boys?" I replied. "Sophia Loren?" We played the mind game to include Katharine Hepburn, Elizabeth Taylor, Marlena Dietrich, and a host of others. You may laugh, but as Velma, it was up to me to seduce the audience into the world of the musical. Once the elevator reached stage level, the sliding doors of the drum opened to reveal me in a shaft of light, with my back to the audience and a finger cocked in the air. With my hips pulsating to John Cantor's intoxicating vamp for my vamp, I oh so slowly turned around and waited for a second. Then I sashayed down to the very front of the stage. I looked at the audience with murder in my eyes, as Bobby dictated, and invited them to ride with me into a vaudeville of decadence. "Come on, babe, why don't we paint the town?" People often ask me if I ever wanted to play Roxy, her rival in the Cook County Jail. The short answer is no. Roxy's cute and conniving, and though I got the chance to play her a couple of times, she will always belong to Gwen. Velma is my kind of girl because she's a fighter, feral, and tough. She's not afraid to go as low as she needs to in order to get as high as she wants. The more desperate she became, the more fun it was to play her. When I first read the script, I thought, there but for the grace of God go I could have been a Velma. You might be scratching your head on that one. How could I relate to a woman who shoots her husband and her sister in a double homicide when she finds them in bed together? It was easy. For Dolores, even easier. I know that I've simply been dealt a better hand of cards to play than the Velmas of the world. Besides, I bought in to her alibi. They had it coming. Audiences, for the most part, managed to see that too, not just for Velma, but for all the chickies in the pen, as Mama Morton put it. At one performance when Roxy shot her harassing boyfriend, one woman in the audience shouted out, "Shoot him again!" And this was before the Me Too movement.
Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Velma Kelly in an act of desperation.
My sister and I had an act that couldn't flop. My sister and I were headed straight for the top. My sister and I earned a thou a week, at least. Oh, yeah. But my sister is now, unfortunately, deceased. Oh, I know it's sad, of course, but a fact is still a fact. And now all that remains is the remains of a perfect double act. Watch this. First I'd da-bash, boom, da-bash, da-boom, da-bash, that's the drum. Then she'd wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah-wah, saxophone. Then we'd together. But I can't do it alone. Then she'd, and then I'd, then we'd. right, I'd say men, yuck, yuck, yuck. She'd say, you're the cat's meow. Then we'd wow the crowd again when she'd go. Attraction in town, they nearly tore the balcony down. And we say,
okay fellas, we're going home. But here are a few more parting shots. And this we did in perfect unison.
I've had an affection for all of my shows, including the flops. I never even considered them as such at the time. Closing notices always came as something of a surprise to me. Huh? Really? I have such tunnel vision developing a role that I scarcely bother to handicap a show's chances. On top of that, I never read the reviews, or Dolores just might invest in a dozen voodoo dolls. An indication that things weren't going all that well was Bring Back Birdie, which lasted the shortest, 4 performances, of all my shows. It ushered in the 1980s, a decade of painfully earned wisdom. Ronald Reagan was president. There was a recession, and Broadway was going through a rough patch, with only half of its 39 theaters occupied. The British invasion and their mega musicals was just about to begin when Cats opened in 1981 in London's West End before transferring to Broadway. Its motto, Cats, now and forever, was considered either a threat or a prediction. Into this world came Bring Back Birdie, written by Michael Stewart, Charles Strauss, and Lee Adams, a sequel to our hit Bye Bye Birdie. Set 20 years later, the plot involved Albert and Rose, now with kids of their own, in a scheme to find Birdie, who has disappeared, so that he can appear on a Grammy Awards show. Loyal to the creative team, I was the only one of the original cast to return. Donald O'Connor took on the role of Albert, originally created by Dick Van Dyke, and Maria Karnilova was Albert's mother, May. Maurice Hines was cast in a new role, Moby, an unscrupulous detective who gets mixed up in the foolishness. In a bid for lightning to strike twice, the producers got, for the show, the Martin Beck Theater, where Bye Bye had played. Some shows are star-kissed and others are snake-bitten. Once rehearsal started, it soon became clear that the question prompted by the title, Bring Back Birdie, was, why bother? The show was a mess, but not for lack of trying, and by some top-notch professionals at that. Donald O'Connor, an MGM musical legend, was a pleasure to work with. But like the rest of the cast, he was at sea. It wasn't his fault. The whole concept was misconceived. Our set designer, the very talented David Mitchell, came up with a wall of video monitors on which would be projected the props. I knew I was in trouble when singing about wifely duties. I like what I do, and clothes were projected onto the oven, and a turkey was projected onto the washing machine. At one point, I was even chased off the stage by a television. Don't ask.
I like to polish this old kitchen table until it shines like new. Contented wife, homemaker, and mother. I like what I do.
Mother, where do you hear what's happened? Gary rented a loft in Soho and asked me to live with him. But if I get pregnant, you'll be the first to know.
Don't need no diamonds, forming or sable. I'm happy cooking stew. I like this life, don't want any other. I like what I do.
Hey, Mom, two guys came to school to hear us play and picked me to join a new rock group that's booked for a 6-month tour in Guatemala.
It's a life of joy, and that's all I need for. I love my children, I love my husband, I even like them too.
Rose, we can't find Conrad in 10 days, so I took a 6-month leave of absence without pay.
I could stand and cheer. Let me shout it out. Oh, yes, I'm a mom. Yes, I'm a housewife. It's corny, but it's true.
It's good news. My honor as a detective won't let me hear of a missing person without trying to find her. So, I intend locating Mr. Peterson's dear mother by the end of next week at the latest.
My cup runneth over.
You can look for Albert's mother if that's all you've got to do. If you find her, you can keep her. I say lots of luck to you. You will not shack up in Soho, kiddo, that I guarantee. Guatemala, no, no. But Forest Hill, CC, you enjoy your leave of absence. Hope you have a good time, dear. But when you come back home, sweetheart, guess who won't be here? I like to polish this old kitchen table until it shines like contented wife, homemaker, and mother. I like what I do. No need for diamonds, homing or sable. I'm happy cooking stew. I like this life, don't want any other. I like what I do. It's a life of joy, and that's all I need for. Yes, I'm a mother. Yes, I'm a housewife. It's corny, but it's true. I do what I like. You know what I mean. I sew, I stew. I like what I do.
In the summer of 1984, Liza Minnelli and I were under the camera lights of Live at 5, the local New York television program at Rockefeller Center. We were there to promote The Rink, the new Broadway musical by John and Freddie that teamed Liza and me as mother and daughter who were at odds with each other. The show had just opened to a lot of buzz, Liza and Cheetah together, but less than rave reviews. That meant doing as much press as we could to keep the show running. We were in friendly territory since the host was our buddy Liz Smith, a popular columnist who had been very supportive of The Rink. After some lighthearted banter, Liz, in her good old gal way, popped a question. Do you ever fight the way you fight on stage? Have you ever had the experience of disagreeing with each other, of really being angry? No, I answered softly. If I was quick off the mark, it was because I knew, and Liz knew, the real answer was much more complicated. The truth? Liza was in trouble, and I was worried that the binges she was going through at the time would seep into and possibly wreck the musical. I was doing all I could to keep the show, which meant so much to all of us, from unraveling. Liza was more direct and honest. If anything is wrong, if Cheetah suspects anything is wrong, she'll say, "This is hot. This feels hot. whatever we're having now feels hot. She made a tossing motion and went on with what I had said to her. There. You want to handle it? I don't. You want to talk about it? Let's deal with it. Then looking at me, she added, I can't fight with her because she makes me laugh so hard. She never does anything to make me upset. As Liza said all this on live television, I was wondering just how far she might go. With Liza, you never knew. All through the interview, she had been clutching a small stuffed teddy bear on her lap, probably a present from a fan who had been waiting as we made our way from the limo and into the television studio. There were so many of them, multitudes of people whose lives she had touched deeply, who were always waiting for a glimpse, to share a word, to snap a photo. I sat in the studio at Live at 5, looking at the puzzle that was my friend and co-star. Liza, the extraordinary artist, Liza, the wide-eyed kid always looking for approval, Liza battling demons that had long been planted within her, along with the dazzling talent. She looked so vulnerable that you never wanted to see her hurt again. Men saw the fragility and wanted to marry her. Women, the resilience and wanted to be her sister. I saw all of it and wanted to protect her.
We're not so very different, you know.
Please.
Well, think about it.
I hate Mr. Whipple.
God, me too. I hate growing older.
Boy, am I with you.
You don't have to be a professor to see. The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
I hate washing dishes. All that grease.
Ugh, I hate Mrs. Carlucci. May she rest in peace.
There's more than a few things on which we agree. The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
For 9 months,
what?
I carried you under my arm.
Seldom, if ever, apart.
No wonder
I can be annoying, scream and fight.
Sometimes I'm no lady.
Yeah, you got that right.
So the saying is true, look at you, look at me. The apple doesn't fall very far.
Hey, are you two okay?
We're fabulous. Come on down.
I'll catch you ladies later.
Mm-hmm. You bet. Oh, yes.
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 Me. I like to stroke some big guy's chest.
Especially Italian.
Oh, mama,
they're the best. You don't need a sheepskin from Harvard to see. The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
Me, I like a guy who'll scratch my back.
Try a little lower.
Scratch my back.
The apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
9 months. At least I was never ignored.
Oh, for 9 months I gave you free room and board.
Your top's mine.
Thank you. I know I shouldn't say this.
Oh, be my guest.
We're not so very different.
Now I'm real depressed. Well, you open a tea bag that's gonna be tea.
You open a pea pod, and guess what?
What?
A pea.
And the apple doesn't fall.
What is death? The big sleep, as Raymond Chandler, the crime writer, put it. Shakespeare's undiscovered country from whose born no traveler returns? Or everlasting life with God and the angels, as my Catholic faith promised? If those questions were too much for the greatest philosophers and thinkers, you can imagine how little I could understand about something that had touched me at an early age. So given my obsession, I was amazed that at a pivotal moment in my life and career, I should be called upon to play death in the dual personality of a glamorous character, the role of Aurora, and the Spider-Woman in Kiss of the Spider-Woman. The irony was that, just as Molina tries to elude the seductive enticements of death in the musical, I almost robbed myself of the role. As often happens in the theater, fate dictated otherwise, even if it took a couple of detours before I landed where I was supposed to be all along. My first encounter with Aurora and the Spider-Woman was hardly life-changing. In June of 1990, Marty Richards, the producer of Chicago, and I drove up to the State University of New York at Purchase to support Freddie and John. Their Kiss of the Spider-Woman was inaugurating the school's new musicals program. It was geared to help creative teams develop shows free from the pressures of Broadway and the meddling of critics. In theory, the shows, which included The Secret Garden and My Favorite Year, would creatively evolve during their short runs on the campus. What Marty and I saw that afternoon was definitely evolving. As usual, Freddie and John had chosen an audacious subject, a musical adaptation of a 1985 Hector Babenco film starring Raul Julia and William Hurt, which in turn had been based on Manuel Puig's 1976 novel. It was set in the early 1970s in an Argentine prison cell, shared by two men who couldn't be more different from each other. Valentin, a fire-breathing Marxist revolutionary, incarcerated for his political activities, and Molina, a flamboyant gay store window dresser, being punished for deviant behavior. Much to Valentin's annoyance, Molina is given to flights of fantasy, which he incessantly shares. These involved Aurora, an alluring and beautiful actress of schlocky films whom he worships. The only film of hers that he hates is the one in which she plays a scary incarnation of death known as the Spider-Woman. Freddie had long been fascinated by the story, and he and John had taken it to Hal Prince, who directed their cabaret. Hal thought it was such an out-of-the-box suggestion that it just might work. He was taken by the challenge of fusing the harsh political reality with the musical possibilities afforded by Molina's escapist daydreams. They asked Terrence McNally if he would be interested in writing the book. He happened to mention it to his mother, Dorothy, on his regular call to her in Corpus Christi, Texas. "What a terrible idea for a musical," she told him. So, of course, Terrence signed on. Susan Stroman, who was just then coming into her own as a choreographer, completed the team, and off they went to purchase.
Sooner or later, you're certain to meet in the bedroom, the parlor, or even the street. There's no place on earth you're likely to miss her kiss. Sooner or later, in sunlight or gloom, when the red candles flicker, she'll walk in the room, and the curtains will shake, and the fire will hiss. Here comes her kiss. And the moon grows dimmer at the tide's low ebb, and her black beads shimmer, and you're aching to move, but you're caught in the web of the spider woman in her velvet cape. You can scream, but you cannot escape. Sooner or later, your love will arrive, and she touches your heart. You're alert and alive, but there's only one pin that can puncture such bliss: her kiss. Sooner or later, you bathe in success, and your minions salute. They say nothing but yes, but your power is empty. It fades like the mist once you've been kissed. And the moon grows dimmer at the tide's low ebb, and your breath comes faster, and you're aching to move, but you're caught in the web of the spider woman in her velvet cape. You can run, you can scream, you can hide, but you cannot escape.
Up until 2003, I'd been lucky in my career to originate most of my roles, except for the occasional classic like The Three Penny Opera or Born Yesterday. Being in a revival had never appealed to me, maybe because I'm not eager to be compared with another actress in the role, or maybe I felt that I might be too influenced by her performance to find my own footing. Then the director, David Laveau, came calling. I have a weakness for handsome men. Who doesn't? And David is easy on the eyes. On top of which, he has a wonderful imagination and sense of humor. He'd taken the trouble to fly out to Los Angeles, where I was performing in The House of Bernarda Alba, as the rigidly controlling matriarch of the title. In the course of a lunch in a fancy restaurant, David explained that he was reviving Nine, the 1982 Tony-winning musical for New York's Roundabout Theater. He wanted me to play Lillian Lefleur, the demanding film producer. Uh-oh. Not only was the character named after Lillian Mantovecchi, the woman who vivaciously originated the role, but she'd won a Tony Award for it. If David was hoping to persuade me to be in a musical revival for the first time, he was on shaky ground. Then he mentioned who was going to play Guido, the womanizing film director in Nine, Antonio Banderas. This could be good, I suddenly thought. I'd admired Antonio in several of Pedro Almodovar's movies, including Law of Desire and Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Unlike a lot of foreign film stars, he'd been able to translate his virile charm to American movies, including in The Mark of Zorro and as Tom Hanks' boyfriend in Philadelphia. I wasn't aware that Antonio had actually started his career on the stage. He'd acted on the streets of his hometown of Malaga, and then at the Spanish National Theater. Now he'd be making his Broadway debut, acting and singing in a second language. That took cojones. The temptation to be there when Antonio opened in Nine was beginning to prove irresistible. Then there were the other perks. The musical itself, based on Eight and a Half, the autobiographical Federico Fellini film about the boy within finally becoming a man. Maury Yeston's gorgeous score, with La Fleur's show-stopping Folies Bergère. A cast made up entirely of women except for Antonio and one little boy. This was going to be a new one for me. In my club acts and in musicals like The Rink and Kiss of the Spider Woman, the ensemble had been almost all men. I liked the challenge of sharing the stage with 16 women and exploring sisterhood for a change. Besides, David had caught me at a vulnerable moment. In Bernarda Alba, my costume was a black mourning dress, and I wore clunky shoes that made me look like a truck driver. The cheetah of my childhood, who didn't like girly things, had long since vanished. Nine would be the perfect antidote. When David asked me whether I was ready to sign on, I replied, "You had me at Antonio."
La cinema today is in a crisis. Directors are so existentialist. The movies are not worth their entrance prices. If no one sings a love song when he's kissed, continue, I want a musical. Love cannot be love without the singing. A string, a clarinet, a saxophone. Take a lesson from this old Parisian and the finest entertainment she has known. Folies Bergères. What a showing of color, costume, and dancing. Not a moment of life could be more entrancing. Then an evening you spend a Folies Bergères. Folies Bergères. Not a soul in the world could be in despair when he is glancing at the fabulous stage of Folies Bergères. Sing at the footlights bright and gleaming. Les striptease like Cantin will adore. Life is too short without dreaming, and dreams are what the cinema is for. Folies Bergères. La musique, la danse, le sol, la lumière. La petite, je les scène de belles bouquetières. C'est la belle passerelle des Folies Bergères. Ah, des mystères. Le spectacle
l'a tout à fait découvert.
The trouble with Quentin, he's the king of mediocrity. He's a second-rate director who believes in his Socrates. He never makes a movie or a picture or a flick. He makes a film, get it, a film. A typical Italian with his autobiography, a mixture of Catholicism, pasta, and pornography, a superficial womanizing, moderately charming Latin fraud.
Grazie.
Prego. And what are his movies about? Just beauty, truth, death, youth, love, life, anguish, angst. Thanks to him, we have boredom at the movies.
Grazie.
Prego.
Darlings, folie bergère.
La danse, la sole, la lumière. A
petite lecène de belle boutiquière.
La belle passerelle de folie bergère.
A des mystères.
Playing Princess Puffer, the madam of an opium den in The Mystery of Edwin Drood, a musical set in the London of 1895. She understands and accepts people who enjoy the seedy side of life, and truth to tell, so do I. But the real draw for me to be in the 2012 revival was the creative team, including Scott Ellis, the director, and Rupert Holmes, the writer and composer. They're both very bright guys. They were able to seduce me without too much resistance to take on the role. My reservation was how I could ever reach the bar set by the great Cleo Lane, the Brit, who so memorably created the princess in the original 1985 production. She could sing the hell out of the score, and Princess Puffer's Cockney accent sat much more comfortably in her mouth than it did in mine. I decided not to try to match the matchless Cleo, and to rely instead on Scott and Rupert to help me put my own stamp on the Devil May Care Dame. Besides, I got to sing Don't Quit While You're Ahead, which I consider one of my personal theme songs. One of the perks of growing older is to watch your kids evolve into some of the most inventive artists of the day. This was true of Scott, who had been in the ensemble of The Rink in 1984. You may recall that, like most of the cast, he played multiple roles, including a construction wrecker and a punk. But he was more of a scene stealer as Sugar in Pearls, Gloves, Blouse, and the busiest skirt on Broadway. He'd since matured into a Tony-nominated stage director, as well as holding the position of associate artistic director of the Roundabout Theater Company, which had done 9. I was in good hands. Rupert, who'd won 2 Tony Awards for Drood, had come out of the pop music world as songwriter and producer for such artists as Barbara Streisand, Judy Collins, and Britney Spears. I liked that he'd initially come from outside musical theater. I think we always need that kind of new blood. On the first day of rehearsals for the show, Scott brought in a crystal mouse. He explained to the Drood cast that this had been my gift to each of the guys on the opening night of The Rink. I had forgotten that I'd done that and was touched that he had thought to bring it into the room. It was kind of a lucky omen. That's what I love about the theater. Nothing is lost. It's a living history. There are things that sort of live outside the room itself, spiritual connections that really inform the work. Sometimes a mouse is more than just a mouse.
I was once your nag, then I met a man. Tall and old, with golden hair, is where my end began. Let him have his way with me, he knew his way so well. Led me down the garden path to hell. Marriage in the end, what I got instead was a bed in Camden Town. And then to me he said, should I send around a friend, be nice to him this swell. Stroll him down your garden path to hell. Make your bed of roses and sleep in it. Cuddle deep in it and pray you never wake. Soon the deadly poppies come cropping up, fairly popping from the seed of one mistake. On my back all day, earning Satan's pay. Took a drink so's not to think of who'd come next to play. Gave my gent my every cent, and he gave me farewell, leaving me to weed the paths to hell. Life's a maze of hedges that prickle you. As they tickle you, they'll tear you all above. Strolling through the maze is amusing too, but confusing when you find there's no way out. Lost my looks by then, couldn't draw them men,
So I learned a trade and earned my keep with drugs, and then found myself a wicked shelf where opium I'd sell. Here's a pipe for you, sir. Price is 5 and 2, sir. Can't you see the garden? It's such a lovely garden. I'll take you there. I know the bar so well. To hell. To hell. A woman, a butler, 2 eunuchs, and a coffin enter a bar. Sounds like a good setup for a joke, doesn't it? But if instead you said, a woman, a butler, 2 eunuchs, and a coffin enter the stage, you would have not only one hell of an entrance, but one hell of a musical, The Visit. The show was no joke. On the contrary, it was one of the most astonishing events of my life, both on and off the boards. I will carry the memories of it in my heart the way that its lead character, Claire Zachanassian, was said to carry the moon within hers. The description alone of The Visit would cause anybody to stop and let it sink in. Claire, a fabulously rich woman, returns to her impoverished hometown of Brocken with an agenda: to persuade its good people to kill Anton Schell, the man who wronged her years before. A musical? That would probably be most people's reaction. It wasn't mine. I knew Freddie and John well enough that I wasn't surprised when they told me that they were working with Terrence on such a chilling piece of theater. As with Cabaret, they were back in Europe, this time adapting a drama by the Swiss playwright Frederick Durnmont. The play had starred Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine on Broadway in 1958 and Anthony Quinn and Ingrid Bergman in the 1964 movie. I wasn't familiar with either of those versions, so late in the year 2000, when Terrence's script arrived, I tore into it with the eagerness of a kid on her birthday. What a delicious and shocking present it turned out to be. For decades, audiences have thought of the story of Claire and Anton as a mythic tale of revenge, the stuff of Medea, Salome, and Pirate Jenny, a role that I once played in a production of The Three Penny Opera. Who can blame them? What woman wouldn't have revenge on her mind if, like Claire, she had been seduced, impregnated, and abandoned by an ambitious young man, who then joined with the townspeople to drive her out in disgrace? To add insult to injury, Anton, to avoid acknowledging that he is the father of her child, convinces a couple of friends to accuse Claire of promiscuity before a corrupt judge. When Claire returns to Brocken, she is ready to settle some scores. Not that she hasn't already. Those eunuchs? They were the guys who lied about her. That butler? The corrupt judge who presided over her hearing. How has she managed to pull all this off? As she sings in the show, I've got a little secret I'm more than pleased to tell. I married very often and widowed very well. Half gypsy, half Jew, born illegitimate, Claire is my kind of woman. Not because she's rich, though it was fun to be swathed in furs and glittering jewels, nor because she's an avenging fury, though our jailhouse chant in Chicago, "He had it coming," would not have been out of place. No, I like Claire because she wants justice and the truth to be known. And most of all, because she loves Anton, the man who betrayed her. The visit is more than anything a love story. Maybe a little perverse, but a love story nonetheless.
I always intended to return. The time had to be right for this visit. I wasn't ready, neither was Brock.
At last, the old lady pays a visit. Let's stop and think, just how many lifetimes is it? Oh well, who cares? Let's welcome an old acquaintance who's home at long, long last. The furs, the gowns, the handful of rings she's worn here. Can you believe that creature was really born here?
Just to play.
Well, anyway, she's home at long, long last.
And now that I'm among you, I notice that you're staring. Where did she get the jewels she's got and all that fur she's wearing? I've got a little secret that I'm more than pleased to tell. I married very often and I widowed very well. Zachanassian adored me. Every touch gave him a thrill. If I said I hated winter, he would fly me to Brazil. When an epileptic seizure took him out at 69, he'd acquired lots of oil wells. Now all of them are mine. So I wore my widow's weeds and walked away. Though Zach was gone, I soldiered on. Now the second man I married was a very small Chinese. Look at all our wedding pictures. He barely comes up to my knees. When the Asian flu dispatched him, three little lawyers came to call. Mr. Chewong Chunks of Chili. Now yours truly's got them all. So I wore my widow's weeds and walked away. What could I do? Ciao, Mr. Chew. Numbers 3 to 5 were sickly. They were quickly laid to rest. Plague, cirrhosis, and a plane crash, which left me quite depressed. Number 6 was born in Warsaw. He was high-class Slavic folk. Though at first he was amusing, he became my Polish joke. When he died of liver failure, someone read me Freddie's will. And it said to my dear Clara, I bequeath 300 mil. So I wore my widow's weeds and walked away. That poor old Pope, God rest his soul.
For money cannot heal the sorrow that you feel. Anytime you feel sorrow, no, 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 money can't erase the terror that you face when you're terrified to face tomorrow.
Thank you.
Hear what I said. When love is dead, and it is pain that fills the day, and life is gray, I walk away.
Well, I hope you enjoyed those wonderful audio excerpts from Cheetah, the memoir by Cheetah Rivera and Patrick Pacheco, as we ran the whole course of her Broadway career from Can Can all the way up into her most recent Broadway musical, The Visit. I strongly encourage you to purchase the book, or like me, as I said at the beginning of the show, if you like the audio version like I do, you can also purchase the audio version. I will give you a link here on the radio show page so you can get out there and support Cheetah Rivera's new book. I'm going to leave you now with some closing comments from Cheetah Rivera.
I've never thought of myself as a great singer. On one level, I consider my voice to be an instrument among the others in the band or orchestra. So I was impressed when a musical director said that I might be selling myself short. Ironically, my humility actually made me a better singer than I thought I was. That humility derails any fear you might have, Cheat, he said. It lets you concentrate on the job at hand. That job was to be in the service of the composers. It was their words and music that gave me a door to the character and whatever emotion I was communicating at any given moment. I thought of lyrics as my best friend, and I worked hard to give them their full due and coloration. The dark, ferocious timbre of Lenny and Steve's songs for West Side Story, the light technicolor wit of Charles Strauss and Lee Adams in Bye Bye Birdie, the exuberance of the songs of Cy Coleman and Dorothy Fields in Sweet Charity. Singing from the Great American Songbook connected me to the character and the show. But through the empathy expressed within them, the songs also connected me to the world. I don't think you really can be a triple threat without an engagement, body and soul, with the rest of humanity.